him. And he says to them, he encourages them, he says, because God gave your enemies the nation of Moab in your hands. In other words, like he showed the success, and therefore he's saying this must be an act of God, and he's encouraging them. This gives the army encouragement. You must always give an army encouragement, and this is the encouragement to the nation. And they followed after him, and the first thing they did was they captured the crossings of the Jordan to Moab. Moab was on the other side of the Jordan, okay? And at this crossing, they closed it off, and they didn't let any man cross over. The reason for this was, is that, see, when Moab had control of Israel, so they had many soldiers in Israel. Now, we weren't strong enough, and we weren't interested in fighting Moab. We were only interested in securing Israel. So we closed off Moab not to allow any help from the nation of Moab to come in, so we could destroy the armies that were in Israel, you see, so that we should be free. We weren't going to attack Moab. That would be too much, you see. But however, just we were going to protect ourselves by not letting them in, that's one thing, from Moab, and then to destroy the army that was in Israel from Moab. And they destroyed of the people of Moab at that time approximately 10,000 men, okay? And nobody escaped. In other words, from the nation of Moab that was in Israel, nobody escaped. Okay? And then it says that Moab was subjugated that day under the hand of Israel, and the land was quiet for 80 years. In Judges chapter 3, verse 20, it says that when he says, Ehud said to Eglon that I have a prophecy from God, so he says he stood up in honor of God. So the Radak says, and I think Rashi also quotes it, but the Radak says that our sages says, therefore he was Eglon was merited that his daughter should be the mother of the kings of Israel, and that is Ruth, who came from the nation of Moab, and she was a descendant of Eglon. Okay? I'm not sure if Ruth was a daughter or a descendant of Eglon. Okay? She was a great-grandmother, I think, of David. Okay? That story of Ruth. It's in the Megillos. Yeah. Now, we have to understand the situation insofar as religion at that time. At that time, most gods that they had were gods of nature. You understand? They had the each thing in nature, like there's the god of the water, and there's the god of the land, and then there's the god of crops, and there's the god. Every single thing in nature had a god that they turned to. Since many nations had that, many times when one nation would conquer another nation, they would take on the gods of the nation they conquered, or the land that was conquered took on the gods of the nation that conquered them, because they might have had different names, but basically they were pretty much the same. If one of them had something unique, then the other one would accept it also, because they would get another god that way. You know what I mean? Now, Judaism was different because they held that there was only one God, and they held that all the other nations were wrong. That was idolatry. And they could not intertwine with the other nations. See, in modern times, every religion says they're the only one, and everybody else is wrong. Before Christianity, the only ones that held that they were 100% right and everybody was wrong was Judaism. The other nations, many times, they had similar gods, just different names. Okay? So therefore, I mean, he stood up for God, but Eglon was an idolater. It's hard to believe that he recognized God, but you know, as we understand him. But he recognized some sense that he was getting a prophecy from a god, you see? And, all right, so he stood up for him. The question is, why did he merit to have this? That's one question. The second question is, what difference does it make to him? If you would have asked, first of all, he's dead. He's dying. Half a minute later, he's going to be dead. So it's not going to make any difference. And two, even if he asked them, you know what I mean? Like, he would have pride in that his children might be kings, but he's not going to take pride in that his descendants are going to be a king of Israel in particular. You know, have a different type of pride. It has no relationship to God. What do you mean he benefited? How did he benefit? He didn't benefit at all, you see, personally. There was no benefit. So what does it mean that he benefited? And how does it work that he was merited? How did she get it? In other words, what did he do that was so outstanding that he should merit it? Now, we also know that a lot of people didn't recognize our God because our God was abstract. It had to be, you could only know him through the mind. The other gods, I mean, you could identify with a god of, especially, first of all, let's say a god of rain. So you see the rain, and two, they would have a statue that you could identify with, you see? So therefore, it would be very unusual that a person would identify in any way with the God of Israel, because the God of Israel was very, very far from the ideas of idolatry. It's very far, very distant. So therefore, if somebody did stand up and showed a certain respect, there is there's a certain respect for Israel. Let me try from a different point now, try and explain. There are people that come from totally non-religious homes, and they'll come to the yeshiva, you know. I always wondered why they would come. And when you speak to them, their family doesn't want them to be religious, but however, their family, many times, I'm not saying in all situations, have a certain identification with religion. Like they want their child to marry a Jewish, not for religious purposes, but because some identification with religion. They want their child to go to synagogue maybe three times a year on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. You understand? Or they'll come together for the Seder, a family thing. They don't keep much, come to the Seder. They go to the synagogue for Purim, you see, or for Hanukkah, for joyous occasions. So the thing is that the child has a certain... When the parents have a certain action, a certain feeling towards the religion, even though they don't keep the religion, there is a certain identification, and sometimes just out of the blue, a kid just wants to come and learn Torah, wants to learn, you see? And the thing is that the reason, I mean, there are other motives for children to want to learn, but I'm saying this is one of them, okay? Now, the thing is that when he stood up, it showed that he did accept to a certain extent, in a very funny way, probably not like the truth, or not he would have turned to God and, you know, everything, he wouldn't have kept Israel enslaved, you see? But in a funny way, he accepted the God of Israel. And many kings didn't, and they had no respect for the king of Israel. On the contrary, Israel was isolated because we were so unique, because we had an abstract God, so people did not accept us at all, you see? So therefore, that identification must have been picked up by his, if it was a daughter, if Ruth Ruth was a daughter, definitely she would have picked up on that. And even sometimes a generation or two later, you could also pick up on it. It's passed down. There's a certain sense that's picked up for a certain amount of time, that underlying acceptance of the of that idea. And then when Ruth met the family from the that came from Israel, even though they weren't the best family because they were running away from a famine and they were wealthy where they should have stayed and helped the nation, but because the father had bad traits, I mean, you know, he was too stingy to help or whatever reason, so he left, so she identified with them, you see. Then she learned the true ideas. You see, through Naomi, taught her the true ideas, you see. But she started, she already had a certain identification, and I think that's what I think the merit is, that she was merited to, he was merited to have his daughter, Ruth, be the father of kings, you see, because it already, he gave over that identification of his, that he had a respect for the God of Israel, even though he looked at the God of Israel in a funny way, but she picked up on it, and once she came into the family of this Jewish family, so then she put herself all the way into it, and especially as she saw the truth, so then she changed over. Now the question is, the second question was, what was the benefit to Eglon? Okay, well, what would he care? You understand? The thing is, there are two types of benefits in this world. There is a personal benefit, and there's a benefit that you are part of God's reality. Okay? Now, God told Abraham that his descendants were going to be, you know, enslaved, that they're going to be freed, and God is, they're going to be the God's nation. God is going to deal, and God is going to relate to the world through that nation. Now, why should Abraham care about that? I mean, that's like an ego thing. You know what I mean? My children are going to be the greatest. You know what I mean? I mean, that definitely Abraham did not have an ego. What's his benefit? The answer is that the highest level of the, I don't know if it's the highest level, but a very high level of the human being is that your desire is to be in line with God's will. You see? So when God told them that he was going to use the Jewish nation as God, part of God's plan for the physical world, so Abraham was happy that he was part of God's nation. You see, that benefit is a benefit, but you might not know it. You're not on the level, but it's a realistic benefit, despite the fact that you do not know it. So what our sage is saying, there's an ultimate benefit that he brought about. If he was on the level, he would be happy with it. You see, but he's not, so he didn't recognize it, but that doesn't mean that he wasn't part of God's plan. God used him as a means of his plan, and therefore, because he did this act, he was used for God's plan. So the ultimate the benefit of relating to the ultimate reality he had, despite the fact that he did not know it. You see, he still, in other words, he's a means of God's plan. That's the ultimate reality, to be part of the ultimate reality. But despite the fact that you might not know it, we still call that some benefit. You see? So therefore, that's what it's saying. It wasn't a personal benefit because he wasn't on the level. Abraham, who was on the level, felt it. You see? He felt it. And he was happy with it. He was emotionally, his emotions were in line with his ideas, and his ideas was to be in line with God's will. But Eglon was used for God's will because he stood up for God, and he was used for God's will, you see, but he didn't know that it was a benefit, but that is the ultimate benefit. So we talk about that there's a benefit. We're talking about not the emotional benefit, but the ultimate benefit of being a part of God's will. In other words, even if a person, like the first half with the identification, that we, the first answer, that's within the laws of nature. But if it's something that God doesn't want, it won't happen anyway, you see. Must be part of God's plan. So the first step, how it happened, that was part of the laws of nature. Now, God allowed the laws of nature to work that way, and or he maybe behind the scenes changed their effect in the laws of nature, but the ultimate, in other words, there are two pictures of what's happening here. In a lot of areas, there's two pictures. There's the act which you are doing for your purpose, you see, for your own purpose, and then how it fits in to God's plan. And whether God wants it or God doesn't want it, or God brings it about because it's part of God's plan, or God doesn't allow it to happen because God doesn't want it to happen, there is that ultimate picture, you see. So when you start out on life, you start out in the on the lower level. But then when you reach the level like the forefathers, where their whole desire was to be part of God's will, that plane is also operating. That level is also operating. And that is what it means that it was a merit to Eglon. It was merited to Eglon that that his descendant would be the king of Israel, because that way he was part of God's plan. The question was asked, if in the according to the laws of nature, there are consequences of everything you do. If you do anything wrong, and good things come out if you live the right way. So the question is why do we need God's hashkacha, God to intervene in the laws of nature? Okay? The question had a second part to it, and if since hashkacha pratis, God's intervening, God's supervision and personal intervention, so then it's only for to benefit people, so then why can't everybody go to the world to come, since over there there's no more it's no benefit and no loss, because you did everything here, the benefit's over here, so why can't everybody get the reward in Olam Haba, in the world to come? Clarification of the second part. Okay, a reward. One of the rewards that a person gets for living the Torah life is he continues on in the world to come. Okay? Now, if rewards and punishments are to perfect a person's soul, after you die, you can't perfect your soul anymore. So therefore, why shouldn't everybody go to Olam Haba at that point? I understand there's a problem with the second question, but however, we'll leave it as a question for now. Okay. But to answer the first part, there are three parts to the answer. The first thing is that when God punished Cain, and he made him a perpetual wanderer, so Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik gave the reason why he did it. Okay? Now, the only thing there's two things that we know about Cain and Hevel. Okay? We know that Cain was a farmer and Hevel was a shepherd. We also know that Cain did not bring the best of his fruits when he brought a sacrifice to God, and Hevel brought the best. Okay? And, so the Rav says that when you own land, and there's a certain pride of ownership. Like, not only I own it, but I'm going to pass it on to my children. It's the pride of ownership. Pride of ownership makes it difficult for you to give to give out the best of your stuff, because that pride of ownership doesn't let you give it away to God, even to God. So therefore, he did not give the best to God. So what was his punishment? So God made him a wanderer for the rest of his life to undo his, help him undo his pride of ownership. Okay? Question is, what about murder? Murder is not mentioned. I mean, he did murder Hevel. Why didn't God intervene for the murder? Okay? He only intervened in this area. The answer is that when God puts you in a situation, he puts you in a situation that affects the source and basic foundation of your personality that causes all the things that you do. In the laws of nature, that will not necessarily happen. In other words, the consequences is a result of your actions. There are certain consequences when you do actions. Let's say, for instance, you smoke. So you get cancer, emphysema. But getting cancer, emphysema might not be necessarily that which you need to perfect your soul. While God will put you in a situation that will help you perfect your soul. Okay? That is the difference between the laws of nature and God intervening. The second thing is that the laws of nature, in other words, see, if I study how to live best in the world of the laws of nature, like I learn through Mishlei and I undo all my emotions, I have a perfected soul. Still in all, that only I'm only in control and only be successful insofar as my actions are concerned, but I have no control over information and facts that I don't have, that I can't prepare for, that the laws of nature I can't prepare for. Like when Yaakov went to war with Esav, sent him a peace treaty, he divided the camp, he prepared for war, but still in all, there's no guarantee that he's going to win. So God intervenes not where you have your responsibility, but God intervenes where it is out of your hands. So therefore, that's where I turn to God for help in the physical world, because it's in an area that I can't help myself. So therefore, I have to turn to God. Okay? The third reason is like this. Question is like this. I think it was Habakkuk, one of the later prophets, that asked the question about God's justice. He asked God about his justice. He saw that Nebuchadnezzar, who was going to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, he saw that he was going to exist for 40 years. And he was going to be extremely successful for those 40 years. So he said, people will see that he will be successful for 40 years, so they'll say, where is God? There is no personal God, because God didn't intervene in this evil. So people will think that there is no personal God, because they don't see God's intervention where evil is so successful for such a long time. Okay? Now God answers that that it's based on ideas. In other words, like a person can see God dealing with the universe, dealing with individuals, and dealing with justice on the world, not through the five senses. In other words, Habakkuk was asking that as do you should be able to see it so everybody could see it for the five senses. God says no. Everybody could see it, but they have to see it through their mind. They could see that God actually operates in the physical world. One of the ways you could see it in the physical world is through the existence of the Jew. That the Jew existed in a very different way throughout history than any other nation. I don't think any theory of history, when they try to explain theory of history, the Jews doesn't fit into any of these theories. Okay? So therefore it becomes a, it must be that it operates in a very different way
Also, Mark Twain pointed out how the Jew operates differently, so that you could see that since the Jew operates differently, you could come to the conclusion that God is intervening and dealing with the physical world. And the answer to the question, the Habakkuk question, was that God said that with your mind, even Habakkuk asked that everybody should be able to see it, God's intervention with their five senses. Like, let's say every 10, 20 years God would intervene on an evil person or an evil nation, and it'll destroy the nation, so everybody will see that intervention. Okay? What God said, no, that you can't see it through the mind, and that's enough. Okay, so therefore, if you could see it through the mind, I don't have to show it within the five, where people could see with their five senses. They should train their mind to think correctly, and then they'll be able to see it. Okay, so they'll be able to see God operating with the in nature, they'll be able to see that God, that there is a personal God, and God deals with us personally. We should be able to see that. So that's the three ways that we're answering the first question, that that why we need God's personal supervision. Okay, but however, the Ramban Nachmanides says that God's supervision, when God supervises the world, it is always with a miracle, suspension of the laws of nature. Okay, he also says, however, that Olam Haba, the world to come, is not a miracle. It's a natural result of the level of your soul, then you have a place in the world to come. Okay, so therefore it is not a reward. In other words, Hashkacha Pratis is a reward, like, for instance, parents ask you to take out the garbage and they offer you a quarter. The quarter is outside the act of act of carrying out the garbage. But let's say weightlifting, at a certain point, naturally, you could, what you're lifting now is not enough, and naturally, you start lifting bigger weights. It's not a reward, it's a natural result of working out. Same thing, Olam Haba is a natural result of getting a natural result of what level your soul is on. That is the level of portion you get in the world to come. That is why everybody cannot go to Olam Haba, because it's a natural result. God is not just performing a miracle to intervene. It's just a natural result. So if you have the causes for Olam Haba, then you'll get Olam Haba. If not, you don't. But God is not changing the laws of nature. But where God intervenes, where God's supervision on this world works, God intervenes in the laws of nature. The question is like this from a student. The laws of nature exist, and everything works by cause and effect, and everything that happens must have a cause in the physical world. At times when God intervenes, why don't we see a change in the causes and effects? If God had to intervene, wouldn't we see something happening that didn't have a cause in the natural world that could explain it? That is the question that the student asks. In other words, like Doug said, we're looking for an effect, some type of an effect without a cause. Okay. The answer is there are two types of miracles. There's one type of miracle where it's a suspension of the laws of nature. That type of a miracle, you'll see, like the water split. There's no cause. You just see waters become, or it says the waters became hard, and there's no reason for it to become hard. Water is liquid, so it shouldn't become hard. So therefore, that you could observe, that there is an effect without a cause. But however, there is another type of miracle, and that is where God changes the direction of an object. In other words, if there is a comet that's supposed to hit Seattle, and everybody here sits down to pray, or stands and prays, and prays to God, and God hears our prayers, so he redirects it. Now, once he redirects it, that could be within the laws of nature. So therefore, the way to know whether it was the laws of nature or not
you have to know, one, the laws of nature, and two, you must also know in what type of situation God intervenes and in what way he intervenes. When Esther had a hard time going to visit Ahasuerus, so Mordechai said to her, he gave her a whole argument, and then he says, "Is it possible that you would put here for that reason?" In other words, Mordechai did not have a prophecy about this, that God was intervening, but he knew that this was the way, this was the method of God helping Klal Yisrael by setting up somebody in the palace that when he needed it, he would use that person to save Klal Yisrael. But he couldn't say with 100% because he didn't have prophecy, but he could say with a certain probability based on his knowledge of Torah and how, based on his knowledge of Torah, so he's able to apply principles to this situation to say how it works. So the thing is, since we don't know in certain cases, you must have knowledge of how God works, in what situations he works, and how he works in those situations. The question that we answered is that when you see a miracle, not a miracle where God suspends the laws of nature, but what we call a hidden miracle. So it could be that it looks like a cause. In other words, the student was asking the question that there must be, we could find a cause. But the truth is there is no cause. God intervened at some point, you see. But we don't notice it because there's only a change in the direction of the object, you see. So the only way to know it is by proving that God intervenes. Unless you have prophecy, then you know for sure that God intervenes. The question is, what is the benefit of, if there is a miracle, is there any benefit in seeing that there's a miracle or missing the fact that there was a miracle? Well, the benefit is, if you see that it is a miracle, the benefit is that you see that God intervenes in the in this world, and that God is personally involved in this world. That's another, you really see it, it helps bring you closer to God by through that knowledge. God does not perform miracles for the purpose of having you relate to him, like he'll just perform a miracle.
Right.
There must be a practical reason for the miracle. There is a situation, in other words, when Moshe died, God wanted to get on immediately with the mission of going into Israel. So he split the Jordan so that the Jews could go straight across the shortest distance to Israel because he was on a mission. This is what the Ralbach says. So it was a practical thing. But as a result of that, we could see that God intervenes and brings us closer to God. The next question that student asks is, when we pray on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we say specifically that God decides on those days who will die and how throughout the year, and how throughout the year. How does this reconcile with anyone ever dying from the laws of nature? How can anybody ever die from the laws of nature? If everything is decided between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, who's going to die and how they're going to die, then how could it reconcile with the laws of nature? In other words, the question is that if everything is decided, if a person is going to live or die, and how they're going to die, which is in the prayers of our prayer books on Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, which actually say this idea, then the question is, then how can anyone ever die from the laws of nature? Okay? The answer to this question, I think, is that God decides that something should happen to you, whether good or bad. He could set into motion certain laws of nature that will bring it about. And I don't think it has to be this year. It could come about that it could be in a few years. But God sets in motion that something could happen in 5 years, but the decision was made now. That's one thing. Second thing, God's decision could be not to intervene. It is possible at certain times God's decision is not to intervene in the laws of nature and allow the laws of nature to happen. That is a decision of God. God has the right to make that decision. And when he makes that decision, so then you are living according to the laws of nature. So yes, there are some people that God intervened at some point, and there are some people that the very decision, in other words, all we know is that God makes decision between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. What that decision is not necessarily that God will intervene. It could be that God will allow the laws of nature just to work. In other words, his decision is not to intervene. That's God's decision, not to intervene. The question is that, in other words, when God makes the decision about not to intervene in the laws of nature, is it because God knows that the person is going to die and he wants him to die, or he knows that the person is going to live and God wants him to live? It's not necessarily so, because God doesn't base his decision on the future. What God does is he bases his decision based on your soul, who you are now. Who you are now. Sometimes you deserve a punishment. Sometimes you don't. And it has nothing to do with what the laws of nature are going to do, but God makes the decision based on who you are. Okay? So therefore, sometimes the decision based on who you are is that God's decision is not to intervene. Not on results. In other words, your question is, God knows the results. I'm saying, even if God didn't know the results, which is not true, he does, he doesn't make the decision on the results.
Yeah, but you've got to make...
The next question is, how can you argue with an opinion that says that God is directly controlling everything and only created the laws of nature as an illusion so that it would not be as easy to see the existence of God? In other words, certain people hold that that God only relates to us through particulars. He relates to me in particular. But there's no system, there's no laws of nature, there's no system. But the thing is, it looks like a system. So he says God made that illusion to make it a little difficult to find God, be a little harder to find God, but really God deals with me in a particular way. That is the student's question. The answer to this question is that if, let's say this is true, and it really is an illusion, based on the laws of nature, so therefore I must live, in other words, like this, I have nothing practically, this, in other words, if I would ask this person that asked the question, would you jump off a roof? Would you stick a knife into your heart? Would you cut your throat? The answer is no, you wouldn't do that, right? So I'll ask him why. It's only an illusion of cause and effect, right? So practically, he must live by cause and effect, or he would be dead, you see? So therefore, even if it is an illusion, practically I have no other way out but to live by the laws of nature. So therefore, insofar as practicality is concerned, there is no difference the way he should live his life, the way I should live mine, or not, he should be able to cut his throat. And he would say, I'll rely on God, because God works with particulars. The question that I'd like to deal with is free will. The difference between free will and making decisions in everyday life. Okay? To try to describe what the difference is. Okay? Free will is after you have... See, in other words, you have a certain way of operating. Okay? One is, you know, based on your emotions and the decisions. Like, let's say, for instance, if you're going to go to college. You could go to college because that's the way you were raised, in the society. Your parents and your society, and you go to college because that's the way you're raised. Well, you go to college, you do a thorough research whether you should go to college or not. You understand? And to think about that first and then make a decision. Okay? Most people make it the first way, but then they think through very carefully what college they're going to, but the decision that they're going to go to college is already decided beforehand, okay? So there are two views of life. One, the view of life is a life analyzed by justice and righteousness and what is correct in life, and the other life is based on my personality. Now, when I have both these views, even though I'm trying to live by one, but I have both these views, there is suddenly a situation that comes up that both parts of me come to the fore. A good example is Yosef, when Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him. So at that point he had a desire to be seduced, and simultaneously he saw the consequences of that action. And so therefore they were both in front of him, and he had no time to think about it, and he decided on which way to go. That was a free will decision, you see. Now, the free will decision sets you in motion in going one way over the other. In other words, when you make a free will decision, that's going to strengthen the direction in which you're going to go. It's going to strengthen that direction. If you give in, then it could be years of even. Let's say, for instance, you really want to undo it, then it'll be years of undoing because you made a move. Psychologically, it has affected you in a very strong way. You can do tshuva, but you're going to have to work and spend years on doing it. Well, if you move the other way, so then you'll move in the right direction, so it'll give you energy in the right direction. That is a free will decision. Yeah, in other words, Fred says there has to be a conflict. There's two parts pulling you. The whole part of you that makes decisions based on your emotions is pulling you one way, and the part of you that is pulling you towards the go towards the make decisions based on the consequences, you see, is pulling you the other way. And both are in front of you at that moment. That becomes a free will decision, free will situation.
Okay, you do something without conflict.
However, everyday decisions, the way they're made is after my emotions has decided to go to college, or after I thought it through, so then I work out the details and how to get to college and what is the best college for me in my given situation. That is either based on my emotions, or it could be based on logic. It could go either way, but that is not a free will decision. In other words, there are two types of decisions that you have to make. One is a free will type of decision, where you decide based on, like, there are two parts of you working. One is the rational part, the intelligent part. One is the irrational part. And you have to make a decision which way you're going to go. That's a free will decision. It's a whole, which part of you is going to dominate of the two yous. A everyday decision is just, you know, I made a decision, now work out the details and think it through, how to work it out or how to deal with it when I'm working things through. But there is, it's just what's the best way of doing it. But that is not a free will decision. You see, even if I do it with wisdom, if I do a chachma, you understand it still, it doesn't get involved in the two yous. In the two possible yous, namely the emotional you, your personality you, or the intellectual you. Doesn't get involved in that. But however, where you come into a situation where both are brought to the fore, and the emotions are pulling you one way, and the consequences are pulling you the other, that becomes a free will situation. Like I said, the case of Yosef is a very good example. The question is about everyday conflict. Let's say, for instance, you have a conflict. Is that a free will situation? The answer is that there are two types of conflicts people have. One type is where you desire to do something, but you feel guilty about it. So it's two parts of your psychological you are in battle. That is definitely not a free will situation. There's also where a person is evil and he wants to carry out his evil intent, but reality doesn't allow him to carry it out. So therefore he's in conflict with reality because he desires to carry out his emotions and the reality doesn't allow him and he tries to deny those emotions. He tries to deny the reality, and he just tries to push through, despite the fact that he will be destroyed. Most of the wicked people are destroyed at that point, where their emotion, where the reality doesn't fit into their emotions, and they push their emotional, the emotional way of living over the realistic way of living. Find that, like by Hitler, he was sending out troops that didn't exist. You know what I mean? Those are not free will situations. Free will situation is where both parts of you, the sense that if you do this, you know simultaneously that you're going to do this, you got the consequences. There's no guilt involved. It's just you know the consequences. And the other part says the desire to do it is extremely powerful in drawing you there. It's the mind versus the emotions. It's not the it's not emotion against emotion. It's not emotion against reality. It's the mind and the emotions in conflict. The question is when are you capable of making a free will decision? Okay? Okay, the first thing is that the mind has to be developed. We say that basically, in most cases, the mind is developed around someplace between 12 and 14, about high school age. And at that time, a person could get involved in the study of truth and ideas, and he develops his view of life based on ideas. When it becomes part of him and he sees this world of ideas, at that point he can have a free will situation. At that point, before that point, he can't have a free will situation because he doesn't have both sides in front of him. In other words, let's say, for instance, a person starts to learn. Now, during the time that they started to learn, they're working. They relate to their old problems and their old conflicts and their old ways of making decisions on life. But however, that simultaneously they're involved in the world of learning. At a certain point in the involvement in the world of learning, they reach a point where the learning can overcome the emotion. They have enough knowledge where it's an equal par with the emotion. It is at that point that if they have a free will situation, then that will be the deciding factor which way the person will go after that. I'm not saying that if the person chooses by his emotions, he can't do tshuva, but he turns a tremendous amount of energy to the world of pleasure, which means now he has to work on undoing it's a big loss. He could still develop and still perfect himself and still have another free will situation where he'll do better, but however, he has fallen behind by that decision. He has fallen behind insofar as his development is concerned, and he has to undo all that part of him. If a person starts, let's say he's raised in a home where they have Torah learning from an early age, versus a person that's a Baal Tshuva, a person that has to change his life because he started off incorrectly. By Yitzchak, when Yitzchak and Rivka prayed for a child, so it says God listened to Yitzchak and not to Rivka. And Rashi says the reason is because he was a tzaddik ben tzaddik, he was a righteous, the son of a righteous, while she was righteous, the daughter of a wicked person. So the question is, what does my family have to do with it? Well, I mean, what difference does it make what my family is? It should be what I am. The answer is, well, Rashi is saying that he was on a higher level because he didn't have to undo all the incorrect views of life. He was guided right away. He just had to make it real to him. He had to see it through knowledge, but he didn't have to undo his emotions. His emotions were in line with reality. But at the beginning, he accepted it because of his parents, and then he started learning and he saw the truth. So he was able to just straight develop. Well, she was raised in the house of evil. Rivka was raised in the house of evil, so she had certain traits and certain views which she had to undo. So during the time that she had to undo it, she's losing in a development of the true ideas. So therefore, a righteous person, the son of a righteous person, is definitely on a higher level, given all things equal, is definitely on a higher level than a person that's a child of a wicked person who becomes righteous. Even though we find, I mean, there are cases like Rabbi Akiva, where he first started learning at 40, first started learning his ABCs at 40, and he was one of the greatest Tanayim. Well, that's because he had better abilities. So even though he had to undo incorrect views, he still had better abilities. He still reached very great heights. But could you imagine what he would have been if he started out that at in a righteous house and started learning immediately? He didn't have to wait for 40. What level he would be. The question is that it seems a little unfair that some people started out earlier and then others, their situation is better, and certain people, their abilities are better. And so the question is, it seems to be unfair about the what portion you get in the world to come. Okay? Now that happens, that's a good question. Now that question is based on a relative value system in me measuring myself in relationship to somebody else. That is not an objective value system. An objective value system is where I just know who I am, what my capabilities are, and deal with it in reality according to my capabilities, not in relationship to anybody else. If I measure myself in relationship to anybody else, that is really unfair to me. Then it becomes unfair, because then I have to work based on somebody else's ability, not on mine. So I'm not even developing myself. I'm developing something that is based, the premises is based on somebody else's ability. That is not an objective evaluation. An objective evaluation is just accept yourself for who and what you are and develop to the best that you can. And develop it means where you see ideas and the ideas become so real to you that you live and make decisions based on those ideas, based on your ability. That is all you can do. That is an objective, that would be an objective evaluation. The question is, if you're raised in a righteous house, then you really didn't think it through, while if you changed later, then you thought it through. That is not what we mean by a tzaddik that was raised by a righteous person. What it means is that his emotions are in line with the result for the wrong reason, because of his parents. But however, once he starts studying, then he changes the framework in which his personality is. In other words, like, for instance, you raised to put on tefillin, you raised to keep kashrus, and you raised to keep Shabbos. So it's a natural thing. But however, then you have to change. Change from doing it because I was raised that way, and I changed the motive to the true idea, and I do it because my mind sees it, not because I was raised that way. That's a tzaddik. While the other person has incorrect, let's say he was raised in the house of robbery, let's say he's a crook. Now his natural tendency is to rob and to take things. He has to undo that. He has to undo that part of him. So not only does he have to change his whole view of life through Torah, but he has to change his emotional attachment to the incorrect view. That is the difficulty of the person that had to change later on in life. But a person that's raised that way, he has to change too. He has to make a change and do things not because his parents trained him that way, but because he sees the truth that this is the correct way of living. Another example of a free will situation. Let's say, for instance, a person is a liar. He works, and then he sees all the harm that it does to his soul about lying. You understand? And he really sees the ideas, and then suddenly he's thrown into a situation where it's the most easiest thing to get to lie, and it's the best thing to do in that situation. You see? Then he's caught at that moment. He's caught between the consequences of lying and the desire to get out of the trouble that I'm in through lying. That would be a free will situation.
Okay, what about this?
The question is like this. Let's say a person was told by a doctor that if he goes home and eats sweets anymore, he's going to die. Okay?
Well, it's not good.
Okay, it's not good for him. He will get the consequences. He will pay the consequences, the real big consequences. That he will die in a month or in a year if he continues going this way. And he comes home and he sees the ice cream standing looking him in the face. Okay? And the question is that a free will situation? Well, it depends, you see. Most people have a conflict between their desires and death. Two parts of me. That's the conflict that has two parts of me. And so therefore the question is, which one is stronger? If my desire to eat sweets is stronger than my fear of death, so I'll blank out that side of me about the fear of death and I'll eat. The fear of death is greater, so then I won't eat. But when I'm talking about a free will situation, is that your personality, there's a personality that you investigate everything and see the consequences in every aspect of your life. That's the way you think. It's a certain way of thinking. That part of you is a separate part than the part that makes emotional decisions. Those are two different parts. So it depends who the person is. If you've been training to think in terms of consequences, and you even do think, and you make decisions, you think things through, and you make decisions based on consequences, and you think things through, then suddenly you're thrown into a situation where there's a powerful emotion, and the consequences come to mind, and the emotions are right there. They're both operating simultaneously. That is the free will situation. In other words, it's not an individual act that gives you free will. It's a personality change. There's a whole part of you that you have developed. That part of you which you have developed now could stand up to the other part of you that has been developing since birth. You see? So they have the two yous standing up to each other. You see? But a one-time deal, you know, where the doctor tells you, don't eat ice cream, or don't eat sweets, then it's a battle between your fear of death and your two emotions battling each other. That's it. Not the ideas. There's one more question that we'd like to ask. That is this. As you see from what we've been discussing, that free will is that there's a certain amount of time that you must spend on thought, knowledge, and to develop that side of you. Okay? Now, how many people have access to this type of thought? So it seems to be unfair that most of the world seems to be that they don't have access to this type of thought, and therefore they don't have a choice of free will. That seems to be a problem in God's justice. A little elaboration. Most people do not have a knowledge of the ideas of consequences, the ideas of justice. They were raised in societies of superstition. They were raised in idolatrous societies. You know, the things like that. They don't have a choice. They never have a situation, a free will situation, because they never had a chance for the mind to develop in these ideas. I mean, there are people that develop in math and science, but the ideas of justice and righteousness and consequences and these ideas in God, that you need like an education. You need somebody to open your mind to it. And the thing is how many people have a chance to open their mind to these ideas? So it seems to be a question that God has created an unfair world. In Bereishis, they have the story of where God wanted to destroy Sodom, and he comes to Abraham, and he tells Abraham that he's going to destroy Sodom. And Abraham bargains with God, and he gets down, he says, if there's 10 righteous people, there were 5 cities that were God wanted to destroy, they were all connected to these 5 cities, and so so Abraham stopped at 10. He didn't try to bargain down if there's, let's say, 5 righteous people. He only stopped at 10. One of the commentaries, I don't remember where I saw it, but he says that the reason he stopped at 10, because Abraham realized that there has to be at least 2 righteous people to educate the public. You need a certain amount of people to be there to educate the public. And what is justice and righteousness? There's less than that, then the society has no chance of making it, and therefore that society cannot pull out, therefore God will get rid of that society. In other words, once they've reached rock bottom, a society, where they can't have free will at all, that society is removed. You see? Now, there are many societies that had great thinkers among them that discussed the idea of justice and that this is not the right way of going. There's a big mistake. In countries in the continent, like of Africa, I do not know the history that well, so I do not know if in that place there were or weren't these type of people that were thinkers that were able to help the people to draw them out of their superstition, but definitely as modern time advanced and explorers came there and they were educated, especially today with TV, they do have the chance to see the truth. They do have a chance to find these ideas. So the thing is that you see that in most cases it seems to be that there are people to educate the public in justice and righteousness and even to a certain level about God. The question is that he stopped at 10 and I said, oh, you only need 2 for each city. So the question is why it should be 10. The answer is that there were 5 cities in Sodom. Sodom was just the major one, therefore they could talk about Sodom. But however, there were 5 cities that lived this type of life of evil. And so therefore he asked for 2, at least 2 righteous people in a city. The question is, what is a city? Because today, I mean, you have New York where you have, 7 million?
You have 5 boroughs.
You have 5 boroughs, you're right. I mean, the question is how you define a city insofar as this is concerned, that I don't know. But however, with TV, I mean, then all you need is the whole world is one city, you know what I mean? It could be. I don't know. So I don't know how you define a city. But it must be somehow to enough people to get the information to most of the society. There must be a city. So if you have 2 righteous people, then God can protect the society. Less than that, then it becomes a problem because you can't, because they will not have free will. So God removes the society so that then we start again, the next society, and they will have free will. As long as they have free will, we won't destroy them. What I'd like to discuss is a little strategy in the book of Judges. And it's the war against Sisera. Okay, it's in Judges 4. And the story is that we were under the yoke of Sisera. He was a general for a king named Yavin. Okay, he was the king of Canaan. Okay? And God decided that it was time to save Israel, right? And he sent a prophetess to a general, prophetess Devorah, and sent it to the general called Barak. And she told him that he has to convince the warriors of the different tribes to come and fight, because Sisera, it says he had 900 iron chariots. It would be like, you know, the best tanks that there are at the time. He was a very powerful warrior, and there was no way of winning against him. Okay? So the thing is that they had to rely on the prophecy that God will help them. So not many people came out. They didn't have many weapons. Not even, in fact, not all of them had weapons, according to some commentaries. But certain people came out and chose up. Devorah makes a song of thanks to God, and she discusses it at length in that song. But anyway, and he told them that they should be on a certain mountain, and that would draw Barak, that would draw Sisera past a certain river, right? River of Kishon. Okay, and that's when the battle will begin. And it says that God caused confusion in the nation. We're not exactly sure what happened there, but we get more information from Devorah's song. What happened? It says like this in Devorah's song. It says, just one second. It says like this. It says, from the heavens they warred. The stars in their orbits warred with Sisera. And the river Kishon swept them, which this river was an ancient river. By ancient, the commentaries say it was a quiet river, and suddenly it was unbelievable, a tidal wave, I guess. And it swept them away. While the Jews, when they went into the water and near the water, they went with firm feet. The horses were firm, or if they were on foot, they went firm, and it didn't sweep them away. Okay? So the question is, what happened at this battle, and what can we glean from it for our own strategies? And now, it could be that when it says the orbits, that the stars in their orbits fought for God, we know if a body, like a comet or something, comes close to the planet, it affects the tides, like the moon affects the tides. So the thing is, if an orbit came close, that would definitely affect the weather, you see. So it could be, according to what it says, that that it was the heavens in their orbits. In other words, while they're traveling, in other words, it must be that somehow that affected, because the next verse says, and the river swept them away. Okay? Now, that's all God did. God just did this one act, caused this one act to happen. As a result, there was a certain amount that happened. So the Rambag mentions in his, at the end of a few chapters, he gives the benefits of what you could learn from it. So he says this river that swept them away caused a few, there was a few things. First of all, it destroyed many. Two, it caused confusion among the enemy, right? Three, the way God set it up, that Barak was on the high land, that's always a better strategy than being on the low land. And he wants to say that when it says that the stars in their orbit warred with Sisera, he wants to say it's possible that the sun shone in the eyes of the enemy. It was at the time where Barak was coming from. The sun was behind them, and the enemy was facing the sun, which placed them at a disadvantage. Okay? And there are two types of strategies. There is a strategy where you have a plan, but you must take care of every step. Everything must be taken care of. There is another type of strategy where you do one act and you set into motion all the results, like dominoes, falling dominoes. Okay? And that is the strategy that God used in this situation. okay, by his one act of getting the planets involved by causing the waters to overflow, or a tidal wave. As a result of that, there was a few results that happened, namely there was the confusion, he was set up that Barak was on the high land and Sisera, the enemy, was on the low land, and it was in such a way that the sun shone into Sisera's face, the enemy's face, okay? So therefore, there are two types of strategy. One type of strategy depends on the situation. You don't usually, in a particular situation, you don't have a choice. But usually, in a given situation, there are different ways of making a strategy. And one way of making a strategy that they're describing here is you do one act, and that act causes everything else to fall in place. Okay? The second thing is that they cause confusion. You have to understand that most people are losers because they feel they're a loser. When you feel you're a loser, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. In other words, you bring it back because you don't put in the same energy, you can't stand up, it really holds you back. Okay? Therefore, one of the strategies of war that we'll find throughout Torah, we always find, is to try to cause some psychological upheaval, a frightening, a fear that will undermine the conviction and the strength of the enemy, the psychological conviction and strength, so they will not be able to stand up. The roof says that that the fact that the river acted differently, because the pasuk says it was an ancient river that never acted this way, suddenly it acted, that also is a surprise. That's why surprise is part of the war. First of all, physically it's a good thing, because and practically it's a good strategy to catch them off guard. But two, the confusion that comes from surprise is also part of the psychological makeup. So that was also confusion. Of course, the destruction that the flood had on the enemy, that also put them at a disadvantage, and they felt it psychologically. So, but the main idea that I want to bring out from this, the main strategy that I want to bring out, is sometimes you could make a plan that there's one act that everything else falls in place. There's nothing else you have to do. Okay? And we know that we're obligated to imitate God, even though we can't perform miracles, but however, we can make strategies based on the way God makes strategies. The question is, how is it possible that a seasoned warrior, Sisera, should walk into a situation that his sun should be shining in his eyes, and that the Barak should have the high land, the better strategy? Okay? I don't know from the Psukim, I have no proof from the Psukim of what I'm going to say, but it is possible sometimes the Jews had no weapons. They had no inner strength that they could stand up to Sisera. They had no practical reason to believe they could stand up to Sisera. And so therefore, sometimes when a person feels that he's in control, he loses sight of the pot, and he doesn't make the best possible strategy. He just goes by his strength of power, and he leaves the strategy, assumes, I'm just going to make it anyway. You see? That is the ego talking in a battle. That's a very dangerous situation to get yourself into, assume that automatically you're going to win. Even when a weaker person starts up with you, then you have to know that I have to be careful and make a strategy. I don't know what's behind it. But sometimes anger and ego operating simultaneously. How dare they rebel against me? Who do they think they are? I'll put them in their place. And they just go straight out to attack. That is possible. When Israel went out to war, they really did not have anything in this situation, anything to stand up to Sisera. They went out totally, completely reliant on God. That because of the prophecy of Devorah, they accepted the prophecy of Devorah, and therefore they went out to do battle. That's what they relied on. Going back to the original, the other question that what caused Sisera to come into the go into such a situation where they had the high land and the sun was in his eyes. I mean, that would be an obvious thing to be careful of. We're answering that his anger and his ego and his overconfidence did not allow him, didn't give him, he could not think straight. He just went and attacked, and he felt his sheer power will win over. Once you're in that situation, then that is cause for failure. That is the cause for many, many powerful armies to lose to weaker armies because they went in without thought. They just thought sheer power could win them over. And it's not true. You have to be careful all the time. Now the story continues that Sisera got off the chariot so nobody would notice him, and he ran away when he saw he was losing, so he ran away. And he went to he found a tent, a place where these people were friendly with Sisera and Yavin. That was the king that Sisera worked for. And they had some type of a treaty, even though these people had accepted upon themselves the religion of Judaism. But however, the Sisera was not against them. They had a peace treaty. And it says that the husband was out. He was not home. So Ya'el, the wife, came out, and she greeted him and said, "Look, come here and hide in my tent, and I will protect you." And she covered him over with a blanket so that if anybody comes in to look, they won't notice it. Okay? And then he said he's thirsty, and she gave him milk. Gave him milk to drink, and then she took a fell into a deep sleep, and then she took a she took the stake of a tent of her tent, and she took a hammer, and she, when he was in a deep sleep, like he heard nothing, he took it and it went through his temple, and she banged it so hard that it went into the ground. Okay, and that killed him on the spot. Okay. Now, the thing is that that I'd like to go over Yael's plan. The first thing is that if you have an enemy and it is possible to show in a situation that you're not their enemy, that is a strategy of fooling the person. So she came out and he had no reason to believe. Like, she showed that, "Look, we were always at peace, and I'm willing to help you." So he had no reason to believe that he cannot trust her. Okay? And so that's the first step in the strategy. Second step was a practical thing. He was tired, he was thirsty, and she did not give him water. She gave him milk. Milk makes you tired. That's probably that's why mothers probably give milk before children go to sleep. Well, here the strategy, the essence of the strategy is that is to show friendship towards your enemy so that it's easier to fake him out and he won't be on his guard. And then also, I mean, then the second part was the practical thing is to give him milk so that would make him really tired, like he was tired already. And so milk made him more tired, and so he went into very deep sleep. So you wouldn't notice what happened. He wouldn't notice that about the harm that is coming to him, and that would protect Yael. So that was the strategy of Yael. The question is that how come it was Yael's job to kill him? And the answer is early in the story it says that her husband separated from the group. There was just nobody else there. Husband was out working. And she was there alone. She was the only one that could do it. There was simply nobody else there to do anything to Sisera. Now, it says that Barak, he won the war, right? He was the general of Israel. He won the war. And after he destroyed his enemy, so then he went out looking for Sisera, okay? Until Yael, until he saw Yael, and Yael pointed out that that she killed him, okay? Now, the Rabbah points out an interesting thing. He says that when a person has won, there's a certain satisfaction, and he just wants to enjoy his winning, you see? But however, Barak was not a fool. He realized that he just can't relax after he won the war, but he has to destroy Sisera, because if Sisera was alive, he was a leader, he could organize another army and go back and fight against Israel. So therefore, he took the time to search him out when he realized that Sisera escaped, and after he killed everybody out, so he realized he had to go find Sisera for future. And you have to be careful. You have to plan. When you go to war, you must plan not only to win now, but for the future. And in our own times, we see the problem of that type of mistake. When the first President Bush went into Iraq, he should have finished it at that point. When he totally wiped out their armies, we were victorious. It would have been an easy thing to go in and kill Saddam. Now his son, 10 years later, I mean, now he has to just go in all over again, and he doesn't know what he's in for, and he doesn't have the same coalition and the same backing. Now the Muslims are not backing him that much. And so the thing is, you see the mistake of the first President Bush, that he just took his victory, and he left it. You see, he just thought of politics and to enjoy the victory. But that's a dangerous thing. You see, Barak did not make that mistake. Okay? We're going back to a question that one of my students asked. And she says like this, why couldn't Judaism have been a religion of just learning? The only real purpose of mitzvot is to make us think and develop our minds. And it's possible to do so without the mitzvot, as non-Jews can do. It seems that it would make more sense for Jews to just spend more time learning and developing their minds instead of doing all the mitzvot. Then everyone would be able to see on their own how to live correct lives. So why the need for the whole complicated system? The answer is if you look at the facts, there are more thinkers in Israel than in any other nation. Okay? So you see, left to the laws of nature, you would not produce thinkers. In other words, we have people that are not, they're not rocket scientists, but they're trained to think. In the world, you have to think, and you have to be a successful thinker to be a thinker, and if you don't have that ability, forget it. There is no place for you. And also, besides that, even among the people that would be thinkers, you do not find that many in the world compared to what Israel has. In other words, a small number. We still have more thinkers in Torah than they have in their sciences. Okay, and the question is, why is that so? And the answer is I think that God had to create a religion. That's a very powerful emotion. Very few people are thinkers by nature. Okay, they have to have some other motive to become a thinker. And one of the most powerful emotions, as you see in the world, is religion. And if your religion demands that you think, so then there's a better chance that you'll be a thinker. In other words, even in Judaism we find that among the thinkers, there are a lot of people that just keep the religion and don't become thinkers. It's not a natural thing to be a thinker. It's a very difficult thing. So without the religion, it'd even be less. So therefore, we have to produce a religion, you see, to be the it's a religion of mind, a religion of thought, so that the religion itself would cause you to be involved in the world of learning. And then secondly, since you're obligated to do the acts every day, so it forces you to think about these acts. If I'm a mathematician or a physicist, and I go on vacation, there's nothing that will force me to think about the abstract ideas of math and physics, except when I'm working on those subjects. But in halacha, I could never take a vacation. There's always a question of prayer. Am I allowed a prayer in this situation? If I miss the prayer, I mean, there's always questions no matter where I go. There's always kosher and the once a week is Shabbos. I mean, there's always questions in everyday life that forces me to become, to be totally involved in this this subject that is based totally on thought, and therefore it forces you to become a thinker. And the question is that modern times we find many, many people that are involved in the world of study in different, like you find in the Asian countries, find in Japan and other Asian countries where they have a very high percentage of thinkers. The USSR produced many people that went into different sciences, and you see they're very involved in becoming a scientist. That happens to be true. And it's a new phenomenon, a modern phenomenon because of technology. So, but it is a true thing. But there is only one problem, okay? And that is this. Besides the studies, the question is, what is the essence of study? What is the purpose of study? Okay? Now, according to Torah, you enjoy learning, and that other people from other cultures and other countries can enjoy learning. But however, one of the basic foundation and the essence of learning is to affect who you are, to affect your view of life. In other words, like this, you could be a scientist, but if you have jealousy, whenever you look at your math or your science, you look at it through the eyes of my competition with others. Well, what we're supposed to reach, when we have an obligation to undo these emotions that cause us to view life in a certain way, so our view of life is a certain perfection of the soul that we're supposed to look at life through the eyes of the Torah. A certain view of life, you see. So, like for instance, we're obligated to look at we discussed strategy before. And it could be two motives in strategy. Either could be the competition, like I want to be able to beat you, and I'll play strategy just to win the battle, or to win against you, or I could have strategy only because of practical reasons. Only where I have to defend myself against evil people, so I have to have strategy. Otherwise, I'm not going to have strategy just for a game, but just to win over you and just for my ego. It's a practical thing. So therefore, it's a different framework in which we operate, and which the Torah, even if you don't, when you start out, you don't operate in that framework, then it's for the purpose of Torah to help you operate in that framework. So therefore, for us, it's not, in other words, and if you are an abstract thinker, sometimes in the world, like you study physics, it can affect your view of life. I mean, we see different scientists how it affected them. In fact, there's a study that the highest profession, the profession that has the highest level of humility among them, is astronomy. Because when you study the universe, the vastness of the universe, you realize that, well, what could you really accomplish in relationship to the whole universe, you see? So there's different frameworks. There are scientists which have been affected by their studies. But the Torah guides you to be affected, and if you're not being affected, they will help you to teach you how to be affected by your studies. Okay? So therefore, that is the that idea of study that I don't think you will find in other societies. That idea of study is you'll find in the world of Torah. You see? So it's not only that Torah gets you involved in the world of study, but the ultimate purpose of study is to help develop you as a different kind of human being. And that is one more question from the student, and she asks like this: is there any value to trying harder to do mitzvot between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur if one knows that he will go back to his old ways afterwards and is not doing actual tshuva? Okay, what the class wants to answer is like this, that the they all seem to have the same approach. That is, if you, the mitzvot are a benefit, because it's a situation where it gets you involved in doing more than you did before, which means that even though you might have not felt tshuva to begin with, it puts you in a situation that it might cause you to do tshuva, because you get involved in the mitzvot, so it might cause you to do tshuva. Two is, it might affect you, the very act can affect you, in such a way that it might make a slight difference insofar as the way you operated before. So therefore, yes, should you do the mitzvot? The answer is yes. But insofar as repentance is concerned, that there is a specific thing. You're trying to undo a specific wrong that you have, something, personality defect you're trying to correct, or a certain act that you have not been doing, and you're trying to do the correct act. And if you don't do it, so insofar as tshuva, you have not done tshuva, and you have not repented. But insofar as the acts are concerned, it is possible that even if, let's say, you're cynical and you say, I'm not going to keep mitzvot, I'm not going to change. It is possible that if you do more on between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, it is possible that it could affect you. So my answer to the student is yes. Should you do the mitzvot even though you're not going to do tshuva? Yes. Did you do tshuva? No, you didn't do anything to change yourself. But however, you should do it because of the one or two reasons that we said. Either it'll put you in an emotional state that you will repent, or it might affect you, the act itself might affect you, that will help you out to a certain extent. I would like to take today the Devorah's song of praise to God, just not the whole song, but different aspects of the song. Okay? In Shoftim, that's Judges chapter 5, verse 15, it says like this. It says, the princes of Yisaschar was one of the tribes, but with Devorah. This tribe was behind Devorah. As was Yisaschar, so was Barak. Barak, you remember, was the general. They were all behind the war. Into the valley they rushed forth at his feet. In other words, at Barak's feet, Yisaschar followed. Then he says, but in the divisions of Reuven, who were great thinkers, the people of Reuven were great thinkers, why then did you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the bleatings of the flocks? For the divisions of Reuven, great were the heart searchings. It seems like the tribe of Reuven was in great doubt of what to do. They're in conflict, and because of their conflict they were paralyzed and they didn't go out to war. And Devorah in her song speaks to them. Then she also says Gilad dwells beyond the Jordan. Gilad dwells on the other side of the Jordan, and they also didn't come. And why did Dan remain by the ships? In other words, Dan remained by the ships. In other words, in case we were losing, they would run into the ships and run away. They didn't go out to fight. Asher continued on the seashore and abode by his bays. In other words, they also kept out of the war. Okay? And then it goes back to the people that did fight. There was Zevulun, and then they go through Naphtali. Then they tell about the enemy. The kings came and fought. Then fought the kings of Canaan. In Tanakh, that's the name of a city, by the waters of the Megiddo, they took no gain of silver. In other words, they say the enemy fought because they hated the Jew, and they fought for no money, even though they were not part of the army. They fought for free, and they just came, the mercenaries and the different nations came, and they didn't take money, so as to because they just hated the Jew. While the Jew, on the other hand, it makes the comparison that we did not fight, you see, and many of us, not all of them, but certain tribes didn't fight. Okay, and this is what Devorah says, and the question is, why is it that Devorah, I mean, this is a song of victory, should be about our successes, and yet she mentions the people that backed out, and why, when a song of victory should be purely about the victory, why does she mention about the people that failed and backed off and were basically cowards? They stayed out of the war. They only thought of themselves, and they didn't think of the nation as a whole, and to protect the nation, and it compares it with the enemy, who went into fight just for the fight itself. We had more to lose than they did, and yet they operated basically on hatred of the Jew, and we, for our own selves, for our own lives, we didn't stand up, and we didn't trust the prophecy of God. These tribes didn't trust the prophecy of God, and they backed off. So the question is, what is it doing in a song of victory? That's the question. This is found in the book of Judges, starting with verse 15, going through 22.
Chapter.
Going through 25. It goes from chapter 5, goes from verse 15 through 20. The students want to say that the thing is, it wants to show the greatness of the other tribes that did fight, and it wants to show the greatness of the victory of God over the that God helped, even though it was very few, even though there were very few tribes that actually went into war, but still and also was a greater victory. Okay, this is possible, but it seems to be, according to the words, it seems to be a stronger attack on the tribes that didn't go in. Okay? I mean, even though it is possible that it is possible that those two answers, the answer that showed the greatness of the other tribes, that even though not everybody was with them, they still trusted in God, and it shows also the greatness of the victory, definitely shows that. But, however, there seems to be something about the rebuke itself. In all societies, when people are successful, they try to hide any type of weakness, any type of weakness that's there. And so it's to make great the people of the nation, and to make the nation great so they don't show any of the weaknesses. But however, and the question is, why do we point out all the weaknesses of the tribe? And not only that, throughout Torah we find that we always point out the weaknesses. We have great leaders, and we point out where Moshe made a mistake, all the different mistakes. We point it out. We're not afraid to point out the mistakes, okay, throughout the Torah. And even in the Song of Victory, we point out the mistakes. And the reason is because success, there are two parts to success. The first part of success is dependent totally on you. You're obligated to do everything you can within the laws of nature to be successful. Only in the areas that you cannot operate, only there should you rely on God. So therefore, if there's any weakness in you, that weakness could bring about failure. And therefore, we always point out weaknesses of the people so that in the future they should be able to think about the mistakes of their lives so that they could correct those mistakes, so they shouldn't make those mistakes again. They must see the cause and the reason for it, whether it was, like, for instance, it seems to be over here that the that Reuven was simply in conflict. Conflict doesn't let you operate. While others might have been cowardice. Whatever the emotion is, you must see if for whatever reason you fail, you must analyze the emotion and try to undo that emotion so as, first of all, it perfects your soul, brings you closer to God, that type of perfection. And two is, in the future, you should not make the same mistakes that you made now. Because if you could correct something and you don't, so then God will not help you. God can only help you where you do the best that you can, and the best that you can is undoing the errors that cause you to fail. And so therefore, but the ego doesn't want to see the failure. They want to only build up the positive side. They only want to see the good side and pride. They want to put pride in the nation, so they want to only emphasize the good side. But that is a dangerous thing, because then if there's any mistakes, we can never correct those mistakes. And so therefore, even in the time of victory, we point out the mistakes of the people that made them, so as to make sure in the future they will correct them. I would like to show you just the opposite of the way Reuven acted. Reuven seemed to have been in conflict, and the conflict didn't let them operate. In Judges chapter 6, from verse 1 to verse 6, not including 6, it says like this: And Israel did that which was bad in the eyes of God, and God gave him into the hands of Midian for 7 years. And the hand of Midian grew powerful over Israel, and because of Midian, because of what Midian did, the Jews made for themselves dugouts. They dug into the ground places where they could hide. They were in the mountains, and they found caves and strongholds. And the reason why they did this, because when Israel planted, Midian would come up, and also Amalek and the people of the east went up with Midian. Even though Midian was in the power, these people also came up. And they camped upon them, or in other words, they camped in Israel around the Israelites, and they destroyed the crops of the land until Azor. That was the boundary which they destroyed. And there didn't remain any produce in Israel. They didn't have sheep or oxen or donkeys, because they, meaning the Midianites, they went up with their own sheep, their own tents, and they came as much as locusts, and they had a lot of they had camels that you had that couldn't count, and they came for the purpose of making destruction in Israel, to make them just poor. They didn't come to rob. There's two types of things. One is, I come to rob. That is evil. But a lower type of evil is, I just go simply to destroy. I don't have any gain. I don't take any gain. I just to destroy. There's no benefit to me. It's just a vicious act. And Midian did this to Israel. Okay? And despite the fact they were so broken, the Rabbah points out that what they did to protect themselves, they made these dugouts where they could hide, and caves where they could hide not only themselves but the sheep and the produce, whatever they could protect themselves. When they saw Midian was coming, I guess they had people looking out to see, so they grabbed as much as they could and they hid themselves and their produce as much as they can. So the Rabbah points out that a person, even in the worst situation, should never quit. You should never quit. I mean, here's a situation where I can't stand up to these people. I mean, the Midian itself was in control. And they came with three different armies from the three different countries. Their whole purpose was just to break us, you see. And many people, I'm sure, were. But as a nation as a whole, they weren't broken.
as a nation, they still stood up to the best that they can in the most catastrophic situation. That is the difference between them and Reuven. See, in the time Reuven, when we were under the enemy, Reuven was in conflict, where the other nations just walked away from the war. The other tribes walked away. You see? But the thing is that the Torah is teaching us that we have to, that we must, in the worst situation, make decisions, be up to making decisions. First of all, you have to train how to make decisions and how to think things through, and then in the worst situation, to think it through and never just raise up your hands and give up hope. And just to accept, but however, to try and work out to the best that you can, to the best possibility. And even more so by Reuven and the other tribes, they had a prophecy of God. Here was no prophecy of God. On the contrary, God was punishing them. But yet practically, and we look in the Rabbah, commends them for doing this, for standing up and for hiding, that you should not quit in the worst situation. But however, Reuven, on the other hand, after the prophecy, they were still in doubt, or the other tribes just backed off. That is even in the laws of nature, you should always do the best that you can. The question that we have in class today is what's the motive for a person that's a daredevil and take unnecessary risks in putting his life in danger? We have a few answers for the different motivations. One is that some people might do it for money. There's a big enough amount of money, they take a chance for the money. Others say that could be one motive. There are other motives where a person gets a certain high, and he has to keep beating that high. He has to look for more and more adrenaline rushes, so that he has to keep getting more dangerous to awaken that adrenaline rush. Some people want to say a person has a certain feeling of mortality and afraid of death, so they want to remove any. They want to show that they have no fear of death, and it's they're above it, and they will go into any situation, no matter how dangerous, just to prove their immortality or their non-fear of death. And that's why, to deny the fact that they're afraid of death. So therefore, they put themselves in that situation. And it is possible that all three motives could be true. In different situations, there could be different motives. It is possible. I'm not saying these are the only emotions. It could possibly be that there are other emotions that will force a person, to drive a person to go into a situation that he puts his life in danger. Okay? So, but these are the three that we thought of, and there might be other possibilities. The question is, what about a person that wants to commit suicide? The answer is that the pain is so great that it covers over the desire to live. In other words, these people all want to live, but they're just trying to prove to themselves something. But if they were able to see a video of themselves dying, like they had a prophecy that they were going to die on this trip, I'm sure none of them would do it. You see what I mean? But the thing is that they go and deny reality. But however, the person that's that wants to commit suicide, is the pain of living is so great that it covers for the moment the desire to live. That's covered over. And so therefore they're able to kill themselves. But it's not that they don't have a desire to live. That's impossible. I mean, unless a person that has dealt with the emotions and undid that emotion, that's a very high level of a human being. Through thought, they could through a very high level of thought, the person could undo the fear of death. But however, the most people, that person definitely will not commit suicide. That person has a real value in life, and he understands what life is. It's just that he's not afraid of death. But however, the person that commits suicide is a person that really has a fear of death. But the pain of living covers over that desire. That's why when a person wants to commit suicide, they try not to talk him. They don't try to talk him out of it. They just try to get him to keep talking. So if they keep talking, it could be that sense of desire to live could be brought out. You see, once that happens, then it won't carry it through. But you try to keep talking and talking. You know what I mean? Just keep him talking. That maybe that moment will pass, and he'll feel the desire to live will come in its place. The question is, if a person is driven by to put his life in danger for the adrenaline rush, the question is the reason why are we against it is because is that a life of hedonism? No, the answer is we're into enjoying life. You understand? There's nothing wrong in that, but the only thing is we're against putting your life in danger. That you don't have the right to do. Put your life in danger. You see? So we're against putting your life in danger, not against having enjoyment in life. It's just that the enjoyment should not take over in such a way that it can destroy you. That's all we're against. Okay, the question is that there was a person, one of the students in the class knew, that he was dropped into other countries for spying, the reason for spying for the government. Now, my student asked why would you do such a thing? And he said he did it for the adrenaline rush. But the question is, he's also doing a benefit for the nation, you see? And the question is, should he do it also? So the question is, should you put yourself in such a situation? Now, we have in Joshua, chapter 2, and it talks about, starting with verse 1, it says that he sent spies to spy out the land, right? So you see that it's sometimes a practical thing, sending spies. Now, in verse 2, it says, and it was told to the king of Jericho, quote, that people came here at night from the children of Israel to spy out the land. So one of the commentaries say it might have been the Malbim, I'm not 100% sure, I don't remember, but he says that the only way it could have been told to the king of Jericho that there were spies there, he says, if they made a mistake. They made a mistake. If not, they wouldn't have gotten caught. In other words, there's certain rules of spying, and the only way you're going to get caught, if you follow the rules, I mean, sometimes there's always an outside chance that something could happen. But he says in most cases, like we said before, we must undo our own faults so that we shouldn't make mistakes. The biggest harm in our plans and our strategies of life is emotion comes in and makes us make a mistake. You see? And here also, so based on that principle, the Malbim says that there must have been a mistake, and he tries to find out what the mistake was. But the fact is that true spying is a dangerous thing, but it's necessary for a country, and if you have the ability and the correct training, and your emotions will not affect you, so then you will not get into trouble. The odds are that it's a high percentage that you will make it. Like, for instance, they had a rule. I read a autobiography of a guy that was a spy, and he wrote his whole life of a spy. They had one rule that if you go someplace to meet somebody, and it doesn't happen the first time, never come back. Don't take a second chance. And this guy knew this rule, and he went to meet somebody. He felt it was so important, the guy wasn't there. He took a chance because it was so important, and that's how he got caught. Always there are rules in spying. And even in spying, it could be very, very dangerous. You have, you're putting your life in danger. But there, it's at least it's the correct motive. You have no choice. I mean, the whole country will fail. If the whole country fails, I also fail. So I have no choice. If I have the ability to be a spy, then I should be a spy. But if I do it for an adrenaline rush, that adrenaline rush is an emotion that can affect my thinking. I have to do it. I must be totally practical so that everything is worked out practically and worked according to the rules of spying. Whatever the rules are, I must follow those rules, or not I will fail. You see? So the thing is that should, in the time of where the country is going to fail, should you do the right thing? Yeah, because if the country fails, you fail. So therefore, somebody has to do it. And therefore, you have no choice. Your life is in danger. But even though your life is in danger, you should do it for, you should work it out correctly to make sure you won't make any mistakes. But all the other motives for doing it, all the other motives are foolish. Why should you put your life in danger for these silly motives that will totally destroy you? I mean, get you killed. And the question is that, let's say, for instance, a person competes with themselves. Like, they're always trying to drive themselves to do better and better. So they put themselves in situations where their life is dangerous so that they could prove to themselves that they could constantly do better. That's definitely also an emotion that you shouldn't give in to that emotion. That's not the reason what should motivate you to put yourself in danger, because of the same other reasons. I mean, what is the benefit of that? The only benefit that you should put your life in danger, there's something practical. But if there's no practical reason to put your life in danger, then you should not put your life in danger. That's a foolish cause. I mean, to destroy yourself. A lot of these emotions force you to take bigger and bigger chances. Even when you're in a situation of danger, you take a bigger chance. To these emotions keep pushing you. Definitely at some point going to push you over the edge where you're going to fail. And in a life-threatening situation, definitely that's not a healthy thing to do. I think in everything. In other words, the question is that let's say, for instance, car. According to certain statistics, you're going to be in an accident. The odds are you're going to be in an accident. Should you go in a car? Well, the answer is practically you can't live without it. I mean, how are you going to live without going into a car? Okay? So then for practicality, you have to do it you have to figure out the best possible way to be to protect yourself when you drive. And you have to do it in the best possible way, and you shouldn't take chances. You know what I mean? But however, you have no choice. Okay? When it's emotion just to drive fast or just to, to put yourself in danger, that's something else. It's a whole different story. Yes, the question is, should you evaluate every action? Yes, every action has to be evaluated. And through your life, in other words, when you start out, that's a very difficult thing. I mean, how could you, there's millions of things. Right, that's what we do in this class. We take one thing at a time and we analyze it. We do the analysis. And then you see how it works, and you think about it until it becomes a part of you, and you start living based on these ideas. Insofar as you do not do research in any area, insofar as there's an emotion that doesn't let you see reality in any area, then you have to know in that area you could fail. And if it's a dangerous situation, then you could die. If it's not a dangerous situation, you'll have a certain level of harm. Okay? The question is that we're dealing with probability. So the question is, let's take skydiving. If you really know what you're doing, there is really no danger, very little. I mean, let's put it this way. Driving in a car is probably more dangerous than skydiving or rock climbing, if you know what you're doing. Now, the only problem is that the motive. If the motive is such a motive, in other words, let's say, for instance, you're doing for the adrenaline rush. Now, that adrenaline rush takes over. your emotions, where you're going to take more and more risks to get the adrenaline rush, then it becomes dangerous. But if you like the sport of rock climbing, like certain people like hiking, and they just go hiking and they don't need anything more. A certain person likes rock climbing, and he did all the studies, he knows exactly what he's doing, and he doesn't take bigger and bigger chances. You understand? So then I would say there's nothing wrong in it. But if the emotion takes over and he's going to put himself in danger to get the rush, that's where it becomes dangerous, where the people are going to these higher and higher peaks where the snowstorms could come in without warning, and there your life is really in danger. It's just for the adrenaline rush or to be the great that I made the top. See, you put it there, you're putting your life in danger already, because you're putting yourself in a situation that's dangerous just for the rush. That is a dangerous thing. But if you enjoy something, there's nothing wrong. If you have it worked out, then I say, then enjoy it, as long as you worked out all the details so your life is not in danger. And the question is that maybe you have to make a different type of distinction, and that is the danger if you make a mistake. Like if you're bicycle riding and you make a mistake, so you'll be bruised. If you're skydiving and you make a mistake, then you die. So or you'll be crippled for life. So the question is maybe the situation, how dangerous it is a way of evaluating. That's true. That's true. I mean, maybe that also has to fit into the equation of this whether you're going to do it or not. That should fit into the equation.